From Texas to Connecticut, North Carolina to Oregon, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the emphasis is on income inequality, but it should be on lifting people out of poverty. Orfi Davanji from the Illinois Policy Institute is here to talk about the policies that further that goal. A special election for U.S. Senate seat in Georgia and a red-hot race in a suburban Richmond congressional district top this week's political news. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The Jones Act is an old maritime law protecting U.S. ships from foreign competition. But does it still work in today's global economy? Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores. And a diagnosis of Down syndrome often leads to abortion. But on his American Radio Journal commentary, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College says, those who are born can lead rich, fulfilling lives. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Income inequality is frequently used as a reason for instituting a wealth tax on those at the top of the economic ladder. But Orfi Davanji, who is chief economist at the Illinois Policy Institute, says the focus should instead be on lifting people out of poverty. He is here to discuss. Orfi, welcome to American Radio Journal. Orfi, income inequality is an issue that particularly candidates for the Democrat presidential nomination like to talk about. Before we get into solutions to this problem, is it a big problem and is it a problem that has gotten worse?
It's true that income inequality has been rising, so that's a fact. I'm not going to dispute that. Some people think it is a problem because if you have people at the bottom of the ladder spending more, consuming more than people at the top of the ladder, they consume a larger share of their income than people at the top of the ladder, then this would have implications for economic growth, right? So we want, in order for the economy to grow, we want people to actually spend a lot of money and basically put it back in the economy. So that's the argument that we hear a lot. However, I think that it's misguided to focus on income inequality instead of focusing on lifting people out of poverty. Right. So I am an economist at the Illinois Policy Institute in Chicago, but I'm originally from a small country called Gabon in Africa, where the poverty rate is 80%. And half of the people there are unemployed, right, looking for work. And one of the things I've learned over the years is that the only way to get people out of poverty is through asset ownership, is to get them to own something, whether it's human capital, right, so getting an education and getting some experience on a job, and or buying a house, buying assets, stocks and bonds, those types of things. So ownership of assets, right, should be the goal. We should try to get people out of poverty and not focus so much on the gap between the rich and the poor.
The focus, however, in the political discussion is more on taxing the wealthy as opposed to trying to lift up those at the lower end of the economic spectrum. So as we look at that, what impact do all these proposals for wealth taxes have? And do wealth taxes really work?
So wealth tax don't work at all. So we had, I believe, 22 countries, I think 22 countries, that rich countries that had a wealth tax at some point, and most of them got rid of them. The reason why they got rid of them is because the wealth tax, number one, is very difficult to administer and very costly to enforce, right? So if you think about what wealth is, wealth includes every asset you own, the money in your bank accounts, your house, the paintings on your walls, your carpets, et cetera, et cetera. How do you compute a credible valuation for these things, right? So the tax men would come and try to figure out what all those things are worth before they could collect any tax. So that would be very, very difficult and costly. It's already difficult enough to enforce the current income tax code as it is in the U.S. I can't even imagine what it would do in terms of growing the size of the IRS to try to enforce a wealth tax. The second thing is tax avoidance would increase at the benefit of offshore tax havens. If tax avoidance is a problem today, it would be worse under a wealth tax. That means that the wealth tax would fail to generate enough revenue to pay for Elizabeth Warren's spending wish list, right? So we got Sanders and Warren with these incredible wish lists. Warren's wish list, spending wish list, amounts to about $30.5 trillion, right? So it would be impossible to generate enough money, to collect enough money to pay for that stuff. So that's another reason why it wouldn't work. The third reason is economic growth would suffer. You know, if you think about who's going to be subjected to this tax, it's people at the very top. And those people at the very top, most of them did not inherit their fortune. Two-thirds of these billionaires don't hoard their wealth under a mattress. They're founders of their own companies. They employ tens of thousands of American workers. They are huge innovators. And it's those innovations that gave us our iPhones, the gadgets we use today. It's those innovations that sustain economic growth and improve living standards.
Would not a better approach be to take a look at the tax code? And we all know there are a lot of loopholes. And if you are wealthy enough to be able to employ all the accountants and tax attorneys to take advantage of them, you can. What about closing loopholes and just having people pay their fair share of the taxes that are already in existence?
Well, exactly. That, you know, I couldn't agree more. We could start by closing loopholes in the current tax code. One of the reasons we have income inequality, rising income inequality today, is because the tax code, the current tax code, actually contributes to it, right? So today, the wealthy can, capital gains are not taxed, right? So you can basically borrow against future income, right? You could just keep your assets and just wait and never sell any of your stocks, for example. Your wealth increases and increases and increases, and you can, you know, enjoy good lifestyle, borrowing against your future income, and never actually paying any taxes on this wealth that's accumulating, right? So those are loopholes that are currently in the tax code that contribute to rising income inequality. So one of the things we could do to fix that, for example, is a plan that I heard from Professor Kotlikoff from Boston University, who says, well, you know, we could just tax consumption. If you tax consumption on a cash flow basis, what that means is, you know, you take in your income, you subtract out everything you invest, right? And then you, whatever's left over would be your consumption. And if we tax that, then you could actually get enough tax revenue to pay for things without hurting investors, without disincentivizing investment. And so, of course, we want the rich to invest, because more investment will actually stimulate economic growth and help working class Americans.
Are we not already seeing the effects of some of this here in our country, Orfi, where we have individuals, and Donald Trump being the most high profile among them, leaving high tax places like New York City and going to Florida, low tax state, folks fleeing California and going to Texas or Nevada? Is this something we would see on a larger scale if wealth taxes were imposed?
That's an interesting point. You know, I wonder how much U.S. passport is actually worth, right? So if Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are targeting wealthy Americans, they have many options. They could either continue to shield some of their money with offshore tax havens or completely give up their U.S. passport. And so, yeah, and I mean, we saw that in France. We saw famous French actor Gérard Depardieu actually leave France altogether and give up on France altogether because of the wealth tax, right? So it's a possibility that people will actually run away from this great country that actually for so many years has attracted innovators, has attracted people with great ideas and hardworking individuals. I think it's very sad that we're even having this conversation here in America today.
We have been talking with Orfi Duvangai, who is the chief economist at the Illinois Policy Institute. And Orfi, tell us a little bit about IPI, the Illinois Policy Institute, and where can folks go to read your writings on this subject?
Right. The Illinois Policy Institute is the largest taxpayer advocate in the state of Illinois. So we comment on state policy, but also federal policy like we're doing now. And you can check us out on the web at illinoispolicy.org.
Orfi Duvangai of the Illinois Policy Institute. Orfi, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Scott Parkinson is at the Club for Growth, keeping an eye on activity both in the nation's capital, also political activity around the country. Scott, good to have you here.
It's great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Last week, Scott, we talked about U.S. Senate races around the country. One of them is, well, there are actually two, but one in particular we want to talk about in the state of Georgia. There's going to be an appointment and a special election. We talked about the potential candidates this past week. The governor did make an appointment or announced who his appointment would be. What was that development?
Last week, we told your listeners that it would come down to President Trump's pick, who was Doug Collins, the ranking member on the House Judiciary Committee from Georgia, or it would be Kelly Loeffler, an executive from the financial services industry. Governor Brian Kemp went ahead and announced his appointment on Wednesday, and it's going to be Kelly Loeffler. So she's in a strong position. She's committed to putting $20 million of her own money toward her reelection because, you know, once she's appointed, she will have to run to finish out the term. And we'll see what happens there. You know, it remains to be seen whether $20 million will scare away any credible primary challengers or if any other self-funders will step forward. Nonetheless, we'll be watching closely to see how the new senator from Georgia votes on key issues in Congress.
So we're going to have that special election along with a Senate seat that's up in regular cycle, correct?
Yeah. You've got another situation there in Georgia where Senator David Perdue is up for reelection. There's been a lot of rumors that Stacey Abrams would eventually get into that race. So far, she has not. So he's in a good position. I think that the president's in a good position to win Georgia, and the coattails there should help Senator Perdue over the top. So, there will be two races in Georgia given the special election, which is highly unusual, and we'll be watching closely.
Now, Republicans, Scott, did particularly not well in the election in 2018 in suburbs around the country. That's one of the main reasons why control of Congress flipped from Republican to Democrat. The state of Virginia hasn't been hospitable to Republicans lately, but there is a race shaping up in suburban Richmond that we want to keep an eye on. Can you give us the lay of the land there?
So this is the district that former House Majority Leader Eric Cantor held. And Cantor had a primary challenge from Dave Bratt, and Dave Bratt beat him. So you'll remember that seat very closely. It was a historic race for the sitting House Majority Leader to lose to basically a political unknown as somebody like Dave Bratt. But unfortunately, in the 2018 elections, there was sort of a national mood against some of these Republicans in suburbs, and Dave Bratt lost his reelection to a woman named Abigail Spanberger. We've been targeting this district. This is a district that Republicans, it's sort of an R+6 district for the partisan voter index. And we believe our strongest candidate in the entire country, Nick Freitas. Nick is currently a delegate in the Virginia State Assembly, and he is also an Army veteran serving in the 82nd Airborne Division. He was a U.S. Army Special Forces Green Beret and served two tours in Iraq. And the bottom line about Nick, he's got a very, very bold record when it comes to issues that the Club for Growth cares about, economic freedom and liberty. And we also think that he's the kind of strategic thinker that can build the coalitions to actually get stuff done in Washington. So we're incredibly excited about his candidacy. This will be, we've already said this publicly with the media, this is going to be the most historic race that the club has ever participated in for the House of Representatives in terms of total money that we are committed to spending in order to get Nick over the finish line. He is facing a primary against a handful of candidates, four or five other candidates, but we're confident in our ability to and his ability to win the primary, and then he will be facing a very, very strong Democrat, Abigail Spanberger, in the general election.
So we have that happening in Virginia. Let's switch gears just a little bit now and talk about policy, because the White House announced a major policy change relative to what most folks commonly know as the food stamp program. What did the White House do, Scott?
Dialing it back, what you've got is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. It's commonly known as food stamps. We call it SNAP. And current law requires these individuals to work or participate in a work program for at least 20 hours a week in order to receive food stamps. What you had during the era of President Clinton were regulations that gave states broad waiver discretion, allowing millions of really healthy and able-bodied workers, work-capable adults, to continue to receive food stamps. And it has turned into the situation where the program has about doubled in cost since President Bush was in office. And the number of people that are participating in the program are really, it's an abuse. And so at a time when the Trump economy is booming, we have a labor market that's incredibly strong and a very, very low unemployment rate, what we're looking to do is to find ways to promote work and self-sufficiency so that all Americans have an opportunity to prosper. And so what President Trump is doing here, he's trying to lift those people from all backgrounds into the labor force, and hopefully this policy change, starting out here in the food stamp program, but I think that it should honestly apply to all anti-poverty welfare benefit programs.
And to be clear, these folks who are now not going to be eligible are able-bodied. They don't have children. They don't have special needs, et cetera. And also, conversely, Scott, surveys are showing that one of the biggest problems facing employers are finding employees. So does this not match up people who are going to be looking for jobs with jobs that need to be filled as well?
Yes. The data that the administration is sharing is that there are currently 7 million job openings in America, and there's an estimated 3 million adults between the ages of 18 and 49 that don't have any disabilities, don't have any dependents, and they're currently on food stamps. So when you add up the cost of that, that's billions of dollars that is, I think, being abused in the system. The SNAP program is intended to really help those that are in poverty with dependents or with disabilities, and it's not supposed to be helping, you know, the college graduate that's stuck in his parents' basement and lazy and playing Xbox. So what we're hoping here is that you'll have people that have been on the sidelines, want to join the labor force, and we'll get that labor participation rate back up, and hopefully more than 2 million prime-age workers will continue to join the economy, and we'll see even more growth.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson. Scott, of course, with the Club for Growth in Washington, D.C. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is www.clubforgrowth.org, and our Twitter handle is @clubforgrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, we'll talk with you next week.
Thank you.
It is known as the Jones Act, and it is a bit of protectionist law that has been in place for nearly 100 years. Is it still relevant? We get the answer from Reason Magazine's Eric Boehm.
You may not have heard, but there's a new plan to tap into natural gas reserves on the northern coast of Alaska, and it promises to produce 4 million tons of liquid natural gas annually for the next 20 years. But thanks to some dumb and outdated shipping regulations, it's likely that not a single drop of that liquid natural gas will go to Americans. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. No guest for me this week. Instead, we're taking a solo look at the Jones Act, a 1920s-era federal shipping law that every so often percolates to, well, maybe not the top, but at least the middle of the news in Washington, D.C., because it has some sort of strange consequence for the ability to ship, say, natural gas from Alaska or supplies to Puerto Rico in the aftermath of a hurricane. The latest example of sort of the nonsensical regulations that exist because of the Jones Act has to do with this new drilling project in northern Alaska. As I said, ExxonMobil and Quillac LNG, that's an Alaska-based subsidiary of a Dubai energy firm, they've announced a plan within just the past month or two to extract natural gas from the Arctic coast of Alaska along the very, very northern edge of Alaska. Now, there are obviously no pipelines serving that very remote region of North America, so the two companies say that they are going to export the gas via ice-breaking ships that are equipped to carry LNG. And shipping LNG from northern Alaska across the Bering Strait to markets in Asia will actually be 40% less expensive than building a pipeline all the way up to the northern edge of the state. But thanks to the Jones Act, that 1920s federal law that regulates American shipping, Alaskans and Americans in general probably won't get to use any of the expected 80 million tons of LNG that will be extracted over the next two decades. That's because there are no ice-breaking liquid natural gas carrying vessels that currently meet the Jones Act's requirements for serving American ports. Now, under the terms of the Jones Act, ships that carry goods from one American port to another must be American-built and American-flagged, and they must also have a crew that is at least 75% American. That all sounds good. It sounds like a pro-American sort of policy. But what it results in is the fact that it turns out that it's perfectly legal for a non-American vessel to pick up LNG from this new production facility in Alaska, for example, and then to take it somewhere else, but that ship just can't stop at any American port on its way. Now, there's nothing wrong with exporting energy, of course. It's actually pretty great that America has become a net exporter of natural gas in recent years, but it does seem a little bit ridiculous to me to cut off Alaskans in particular from the benefits of these resources that are found literally in their own backyards. And that's doubly true considering the fact that Alaskans pay higher than average energy prices, a fact that is itself partially attributable to the Jones Act. And it's not just Alaska, actually. All remote parts of the United States that do not have access to natural gas pipelines suffer because of the Jones Act. Puerto Rico imports natural gas from Russia because it's illegal for non-Jones Act compliant ships to ship natural gas from Texas or Louisiana down to Puerto Rico, even though it's obviously much closer. The same thing happened last winter in New England. There was a problem with a major natural gas pipeline in the Northeast, and so there was actually a shortage of natural gas, and so it was Russian natural gas that had to be imported to supply Boston and some of the other parts of New England. The Jones Act evidently creates large cost inefficiencies by protecting the shipbuilding industry, which is ultimately just a tiny sliver of the United States economy, at the expense of just about every other U.S. industry. Think about any industry that uses natural gas or uses energy, electricity created by natural gas. According to research from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, that's the OECD, they concluded that abolishing the Jones Act would lower the cost of shipping between U.S. ports by as much as 50%, and that it would boost the American economy by about $135 billion. That's three times the size of the entire U.S. shipbuilding industry. In the meantime, the artificially higher shipping costs created by the Jones Act have direct consequences for people who live in places like Puerto Rico or Alaska. The median income in Puerto Rico is less than half of what it is in the poorest U.S. state, but the cost of living there is higher than the U.S. average. In Alaska, Anchorage is actually the 21st most expensive city to live in the United States, despite the fact that incomes there are obviously well below U.S. average. And for all of the consequences that it creates, the Jones Act actually hasn't done a great job at protecting U.S. shipbuilding, which is really its stated purpose and sort of the reason why it exists in the first place. The number of ships that meet the Jones Act requirements for operating between American ports has shrunk from 193 in 2000 to just 99 last year. It costs about three times as much to build a cargo ship in America as it does in some other countries, according to the Cato Institute. And American shipping companies, no surprise, respond to that incentive by buying more foreign-built ships. So that means there are then fewer ships capable of serving American ports, and it ends up just sort of being a bad feedback loop here. Indeed, the big shipyard in Philadelphia that's twice been bailed out at taxpayer expense currently has no orders for new ships to be built there, and the most recent vessel that was built there was a $200 million cargo ship that will operate between the West Coast and Hawaii, but it is six times smaller and yet $50 million more expensive than the world's largest cargo ship, which was built in South Korea last year. So it's really no wonder that there aren't any liquid natural gas carriers that meet the Jones Act requirement. After all, if you create legal barriers that artificially raise the cost of doing business in one place, investment and jobs are naturally going to flow somewhere else. Now, Senator Mike Lee has introduced a bill to repeal the Jones Act. We actually talked about that on this same program about 8 months ago when this was last in the news. And President Donald Trump has even offered a little bit of tepid support for this idea, but he doesn't seem too invested in it. And so the end result of this ludicrous pile of protectionism is that Alaskan natural gas will be sent to Asia while Alaskans pay to import their fuel from Russia and elsewhere. Global trade is a great thing, don't get me wrong, but prohibiting Americans from buying an American-produced product like natural gas just because it wasn't delivered in an American-built ship, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out more about the Jones Act in the next issue of Reason Magazine, hitting newsstands in the next few weeks. We're in the middle of our webathon right now, so click over to Reason.com and support the work that we do here. And I'll be back next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Those with Down syndrome have much to offer, and the condition should not be used as an excuse to have an abortion. So says Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College on this American Radio Journal commentary.
My family just visited Chocolate World at Hershey Park in Hershey, Pennsylvania, the so-called sweetest place on earth. For those unfamiliar, it's a giant candy land, a chocolate paradise. The primary attraction is a tour where visitors ride in self-guided vehicles through an exhibit learning about the history of Hershey's chocolate. At the end of the tour stands a Hershey's employee who hands everyone a complimentary chocolate bar. It's a highlight. The last several times we've done the tour, the boy handing out chocolate has been a kid with Down syndrome, a job that he does without a hitch. It's an added sweet thing that makes you smile. In fact, everyone smiles. I observe a mom who looks him in the eye and says very deliberately, "Thank you very much." I generally say something like, "Thank you, sir." But what strikes me about the moment is something much less happy. Nonetheless, I think it needs to be expressed. While probably 80 to 90% of the people passing through that line at Hershey happily accept a chocolate bar from that Down syndrome child, actually the number is probably more like 100%, it's tragic that upwards of 80 to 90% of women in America who receive a prenatal identification of a Down syndrome child choose to abort. In Denmark, the rate is 98%. And in Iceland, officials assert that they have almost completely eliminated Down syndrome. Says Kerry Stephenson, a geneticist in Iceland, quote, "My understanding is we've basically eradicated, almost, Down syndrome from our society. That there is hardly ever a child with Down syndrome in Iceland anymore," unquote. Really? Wow. How so? What has Iceland done? A magic pill? Surgery in the womb? Chromosomal engineering? No. They've done so by so thoroughly identifying Down syndrome in utero and creating a culture that embraces abortion that Down syndrome children are not born to begin with. Only one or two Down syndrome children are born each year in Iceland. Oftentimes, those one or two result from parents having received inaccurate pre-screenings. Says one health official in Iceland, "We don't look at abortion as a murder. We look at it as a thing we ended. We ended a possible life that may have had a huge complication, preventing suffering for the child and the family." Some solution, eh? But what millions of Down syndrome children like that boy at Chocolate World show us is that these children are not a thing to be ended. They are lives to be welcomed. And as anyone with a Down syndrome child will tell you, they are happy. They are literally among the happiest people on the planet, bereft of the anxieties and complexities and moods and depressions that afflict so many others. One of my favorite testimonies to such human beings and how they can bring out the best in us is a letter that Ronald Reagan received from New York's Cardinal Terence Cook, which Reagan shared in a July 1987 talk to pro-life leaders. Cook had told Reagan, quote, "The gift of life, God's special gift, is no less beautiful when accompanied by illness or weakness, hunger or poverty, mental or physical handicaps, loneliness or old age. Indeed, at these times, human life gains extra splendor as it requires our special care, concern, and reverence. It is in and through the weakest of human vessels that the Lord continues to reveal the power of his love." Unquote. Yes, the gift of life is God's special gift, and it's no less beautiful when it involves a Down syndrome person. Quite the contrary, it's in caring for such people that human life indeed carries extra splendor and can bring out the best in all of us. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliate, WVWP-FM in Fort Gay, West Virginia. Welcome to our new listeners in the Mountain State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.